Welcome back to Word and Table, a weekly podcast on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship and why it is vital in our world today. I'm your host, Alex Wilgus, and I am here, as always, with Father Stephen Gauthier. Welcome back, Father Stephen.
Great to be back, Alex.
Father Stephen is the canon theologian of the Diocese of the Upper Midwest in the Anglican Church in North America, and he is director of formation at St. Paul's House of Formation in the Greenhouse Movement. Father Stephen, we are continuing our series on the history, the first three centuries of the history of the church. Last week we did the first 100 years, and today we're going to do the next 100 years, so the second century. Last time we started with kind of the big picture, so let's start with the overall, maybe one sentence description of the what happens to the church in the second century.
I would call it making our case. It's the age of the apologists, of people actually explaining the faith.
Mm-hmm. So we had talked about how Christianity is growing up in this Roman Empire that kind of has this cultural ferment going on. So at this point, we've got a more robust Christianity starting to kind of make itself known on different levels.
It's really now permeating into different levels of society. Mm. It's moving up. So we're actually getting educated people. More and more educated people are actually coming to the faith. Some with professional backgrounds and things in philosophy and the like, and they're actually making a case for the faith.
Okay. So we left off last time about talking about the kind of tense situation between the Christians and the rest of the Jewish sects. So what's going on at this point?
Well, things get worse in the Holy Land. We said that things were getting tense between Christians and Jews about, hey, you're not really Jews, and maybe you're not or you're not one of us, or mm-hmm. Maybe we're a different religion. But what really breaks everything is going to be the next development. Is the Romans decide? Remember, we say the temple was destroyed. They build a temple, on the site of the a Roman temple on the side of what had been the temple, etc. And this leads to a revolt, the Bar Kokhba revolt, mm-hmm. in 132-135. And this was actually had much more serious repercussions in some ways than the revolt of 70.
I see.
The Romans now are determined that this has got to end.
Okay.
So they engage in ethnic cleansing.
Mm.
So what happens is those who are revolting lose against Rome, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what they do is, for example, one of the things with ethnic cleansing, first of all, Jews can't even visit Jerusalem or under pain of death.
Oh, wow.
Which is renamed Aeolia Capitolina, mm-hmm. is the new name of the city. And they decide to try to take the Jews out of Judea. For example, it won't be Judea anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's now become Palestine. Which is strange because the name Palestina means land of the Philistines. So the Philistines are a coastal people.
Okay.
But suddenly that's how the term comes to be applied to say we want to remove everything Jewish that had been here as part of the ethnic cleansing.
Okay.
So that's where you get that term.
And this is kind of what Romans did to cities that ticked them off, right? They just kind of completely cut them off from the map, right? Like,
well, in this case, after what had happened in 70 AD, to have this happen again.
Uh-huh.
The Romans figured that this was the end. But the result is in Judaism. Judaism retrenches. It really realized, first of all, that with the temple gone since 70 AD, we have a problem. Like with the Babylonian captivity, how are you a Jew without a temple?
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's going to give birth to historically what we call rabbinic Judaism.
Yeah.
This is really the beginning of rabbinic Judaism in the classical sense. And one thing they do is they say, we have got to really define who we are. Because very often we define ourselves in the face of a challenge. Mm-hmm. For example, a lot of people would argue, we could talk about this in some other program, that Roman Catholicism really is born from the Reformation.
Oh, right.
It's really the
as
reaction.
We know it.
Mm-hmm. As we know it is really very much a Orthodox Judaism didn't exist until the 18th century in the sense that every Jew was a Jew.
Yeah.
But then you had the Jewish Enlightenment called the Haskalah, where people began challenging some very important things about the Jewish faith. People said, "Wait, that's not our faith."
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to really redefine what does it mean to be a Jew in a traditional sense.
Right.
So that's what happens here. And one of the things is they blame the experience with Christianity in breaking sort of the unity of Judaism and things. So they actually add to the synagogue prayers a curse on heretics and Christians.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
You
so,
know,
so that kind of, that kind of, it'd be kind of hard to go to a synagogue, I guess.
Actually, it's meant as a safety measure, basically. It means we don't have to worry about Christians infiltrating into our...
Sure, sure,
into
yeah.
into the synagogue, etc. That was replaced later. And also there's a special, they define the canon of scripture. Mm-hmm. They say some of the books Christians were quoting, what we call the Apocrypha, which seem to speak very highly, are very much keeping with the Christian message.
Yeah.
They redefine the canon. They basically, the Pharisees, sometimes people wonder, whatever happened to the Pharisees? Well, they become Judaism.
Okay.
The Pharisees, rabbinical, the Sadducees are gone. They're
so,
toast.
So that stream kind of
they
picks
take over.
Up. Okay.
The Sadducees are gone. The Sadducees depend on having a temple.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, that's right.
Without a temple, a priesthood isn't of much good, mm-hmm. and so they're gone, so it's basically the Pharisees. So what happens is, from this time forward, Christianity and Judaism are truly separate religions. They see each other.
Yeah.
Is no way being family.
Okay, so they've really parted ways at this
point. They've
parted
ways.
So how's the church doing with the rest of the empire? So, you know, I think where we left off, we had gotten, there was a lot of interest, and there had been evangelism and church planting, some popular mob violence backlash here and there. But by the second century, how are we doing with the empire?
Well, let me explain. There's some real hostility is starting to develop in popular things for several reasons, some understandable reasons. One is the absence from civic life. Remember, in traditional society, religion permeates life. Every society has a religion, which is the way we do things. You know, mm-hmm. here are rites of passage and things. So when people refuse to participate, it's often taken as a rejection of the society.
Mm.
So imagine it's like, see, people not saying the Pledge of Allegiance type of thing. Well, why? That seems harmless enough. The people would have that reaction. Why are you, you seem to be wanting to cut yourselves off from us.
Hmm.
Matter of fact, they called Christians the misanthropoi, basically means the man-haters. You just can't get along with other people.
Hmm.
You know, we're willing to get along with you. The Romans were happy to attract the other people's religions and things, but why are you, you won't respect us, you won't, but especially religion was connected with the Roman way of life. And they really would no longer go to things involved sacrifices and things, which is everything.
Sure, sure, sure.
Imagine the 50s here in America, everywhere you went, we'd begin with a prayer. Imagine somebody who conscientiously wouldn't go to anything that began with prayers or a Bible reading.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The next thing is secret meetings. Remember, Christians, you didn't get to know the full, you couldn't participate in Eucharist until you were actually a Christian, a baptized Christian. And Romans were very suspicious of this. These people met before dawn,
mm-hmm.
in secret meetings. What good could be going on in the secret meeting? The haughtiness towards the pagan gods. You like in the Old Testament, they always mock the gods. Your gods of silver and gold. Well, these are people's gods. This was understandably not always taken well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I imagine it would be a little bit offensive, I guess, to be told, you know, your mm-hmm. gods don't exist or don't matter. Yeah.
Or a refusal to worship the emperor. Again, the emperor was just, that was considered just part of being a patriot.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Romans, from a Roman vantage point. So what's the harm of like saluting the flag? So a lot of people felt that there was something standoffish about Christians towards the society, and that caused a degree of suspicion towards them. Again, persecution is getting bigger, but it's still local. And it's sporadic. Some of the outbreaks are like at the martyrs of Lyon. We have, I think it's like something 50 martyrs there.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be pretty bad. Ignatius of Antioch, of course, was arrested and taken to Rome, where he's martyred. Polycarp of Smyrna was burned alive. You know, Ignatius was actually thrown to the lions, literally. We have the North African martyrs, which is our earliest Christian text in Latin.
Really? Oh,
yeah,
Latin.
Yeah.
Okay.
The official Roman response was basically, we have that famous letter of Pliny, who's a great writer, Pliny the Younger.
Mm-hmm.
His dad was a scientist in Roman terms. He's a real hoot. Pliny the Elder. I mean, what people went for science there. Is,
okay.
But his son's a really good writer. He wrote great letters. But he wrote once a letter to Trajan. He said, how do I deal with this Christian thing? And the basic thing is, don't look for trouble.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
You know, don't look for trouble. Don't take, you know, people saying this person's a Christian. But again, if people start causing trouble.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Okay, I see.
But we do end up having martyrs. But actually what happens when we have martyrs like Leon and things is people are really impressed by Christians when Christians are martyred. They're
mm-hmm.
impressed by their steadfastness. And actually, Tertullian says, he said, martyrs are like seeds for a new church. When you have martyrs, you seem to have more Christians, not less.
Sure, sure,
because people would be impressed and see, it was really vouched for the, there's something really here.
Yeah, blood of the martyrs,
the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Well, that's, I mean, that's so part of our own history and the beginning of our own, you know, sanctoral calendar and things like this. So this is really starting to pick up in the second century.
Again, because there are more and more Christians in more visible places, some educated people and things, which seems more dangerous to the society.
Sure.
When you have some people at the bottom or something, but you know, wow, we're getting some serious people.
Yeah. 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 If you start convincing, like, you know, people that really have a big impact on society, then you're going to get more hostility, I guess. Yeah, so tell me about how the Christians are interfacing with these new layers of society, with elites, and I imagine you've got pagans and the like. So how are we starting to mix with them?
Well, what we're doing is we want to give Peter said, be ready to give a reason for the hope that's in you. And these people, that's what we call them, the apologists. And again, for people who aren't familiar, the word apology means a defense. It doesn't mean, I'm so sorry. You know, it's the defense of Christianity. But we have, and basically there are three things they would talk about. One is the thing, explain Christian faith and morals. There are a lot of false notions out there. What's going on at these secret meetings? Some accused of cannibalism, because we used very vivid language to describe the Eucharist. Or when we talk about the kiss of peace and things like, these must be orgies, something that would certainly resound in Roman ears as believable.
Yeah.
So they would emphasize, here's what we actually believe, our actual faith and morals. We actually are, our morals are impeccable. The idea that we're having love feasts in the sense of an orgy is exactly the opposite. Attack on pagan view of man and the world. They see this as a substantively defective view.
So what is the pagan view of man and the world?
Well, the fact that they don't have a high view of man and the world.
Oh, I see.
Saying,
yeah.
They're basically saying no, that, you know, the Christian message, you know, basically, again, pagan religion, as I explained in our first episode, was not something that involved the higher things, basic things, and saying, no, it's the basic paganism as opposed to philosophy just really was not getting it.
Sure, sure.
And finally, insistence on loyalty to the emperor. Christians insisted we were the best citizens. We have no trouble. We are good Romans. We have that in the New Testament. You know, the emphasis of, we are the best Romans. We go beyond the law.
Yeah.
You know, to things. The only things we won't do is worship, you know, religious things. But we, when it comes, otherwise, we're good Romans.
Sure, sure, sure.
And we have some very interesting, we have Aristides of Athens writes to Hadrian. Justin Martyr is fabulous. He writes to Marcus Aurelius. But he also gives us one of the best views of the Roman Church.
Really?
He actually tells us, for example, what a Eucharist looked like at Rome, what a baptism looked like at Rome. And Rome is really in a special place because it was the church of Peter and Paul and things. So we have a lot of really good information from him. Melito of Sardis writes to Marcus Aurelius, Athenagoras of Athens, and Tertullian of Carthage. So we have a lot of really good writers who are explaining our faith, giving a serious account for what Christians believe.
Got it. Got it. And these are being received variously. People are still kind of trying to decide what.
Well, it's getting out there on the table that these people, there's a serious argument here.
So this is more than just like a few. This is more than just another mystery cult.
It's not a mystery cult, which is just, oh, you have gods, we have gods, but ours are better.
Like this is a whole way of seeing the world, and it stands opposed to paganism, but it has its own internal consistency.
You're putting us in the wrong category.
And not only that, but it sounds like you're saying that, like, this is good for the empire.
It's good for the empire.
Yeah.
It's not a threat to the empire.
Sure. Okay, great, great. So that's all right. So that's how we're interfacing with the rest of the culture. What's going on inside the church? How are we developing ourselves?
Well, at the end of the New Testament, we already see this in John a lot. Gnosticism's a real problem. Why? Because it's really what smart people are thinking at the time. It's hard not to see through those lenses.
Okay.
And the Greek idea, again, of looking down on material things and focusing on the soul, you know, the immaterial is being what's really important, that everything material is a diversion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somehow the soul is captured in matter. And so it's a temptation for people who honestly come to Christianity to sort of put these views on top of their Christian beliefs.
Okay.
To try to understand, you know, they're wearing the glasses of Gnosticism and looking at the gospel of Jesus, and they're getting a very warped view, like a funhouse mirror.
Okay, I see.
And so, remember, there are two things that we have, typically, with Gnosticism. If you don't think matter is important, one thing you could say, well, who cares what I do then? So you always have the tendency that Paul had to worry about of people saying, well, I can do with my body what I want. It doesn't matter as long as my soul's in the right place.
Sure, sure, sure.
A more common view, though, was actually people become very anti-matter. They would say, you know, we need to be really almost like ascetics, you know, about very little eating or eating very simple things or abstaining from sexual intimacy, those kind of things. We want to distance ourselves as much as we can from our body.
Okay.
So we have a number of heresies that arise in the church applying this to Jesus. We have one I named Cerinthus, for example. It was so scandalous that, you know, how can a flesh and blood human being, with everything that means, be God? And so he says, well, it's the Spirit of God. Remember Jesus' baptism, the Holy Spirit goes down?
Yeah.
So it's sort of, no, it's the Spirit descends upon this human being, Jesus.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And then later he leaves him.
All right.
By the way, that tradition is maintained by Islam, which has the idea that Jesus, not as being God this way, but that somehow Jesus is swapped out. He doesn't, you know, on the cross. And
okay.
So we don't have that at the end. Basilides said, well, Christ was sort of an illusion. He's like a hologram. You know, he was there so God could communicate in things with us as a teacher and things, but it's just the appearance. He appeared to suffer in
things. I see.
So it probably can't have, the idea of God being involved with flesh and blood is just too disgusting from that point of view.
Yeah.
By the way, something that might be interesting to our listeners, it's sort of a footnote, but you might find it interesting. Remember, sometimes people are bothered when Paul says to Timothy, women might even be saved through childbearing. Mm-hmm. And they say, oh boy, that sounds patriarchy and things.
Right.
They have it backwards. With Gnosticism, women were looked down upon by Gnostics because they were so physical in the sense that they had maternity.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, that was what really made women second-class citizens, because of men, it was possible to imagine being detached. But women, by the very nature, had created more matter.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They were the problem. Huh. And so the question, some even argued that a woman who died in pregnancy was somehow damned forever, you know, was lost forever, because this is the worst possible thing a person could do is bring more matter into the world. So he's being ironic when Paul's talking to Timothy, these people who say, like, they said you can't marry.
Yeah,
you can't. He's talking about Gnostics, and he says, and I'm going to tell you, women are even saved through childbearing.
Okay.
Rather than this be something that goes against them spiritually, I think it's a spiritual plus.
Yeah,
That's the context for that saying.
Oh, interesting. I didn't
realize
that.
Rather than being lost through childbearing, he said, no, I think if anything, they're saved. If anything, they're saved through childbearing.
Yeah.
It's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Okay.
So we have Valentinus. Is basically the idea Christ is a teacher who just is helping tell us, pointing us in the right direction, that inner spirit. Marcion really goes crazy. Marcion says, look, that God of the Old Testament, you know, he didn't make the world and matter. How could that be the good God? Now, remember, at the time, we have one of the major world religions. The one the Romans knew most about was right next door in what today would be Iran, called Persia.
Mm-hmm.
It was Zoroastrianism, has two gods to explain good and evil. The good God, Ahura Mazda, and the bad God, Ahriman. So he argued, that's what's really happening, is he argues that the God of the Old Testament, since he makes matter, is the bad one.
And the good one.
He's a demiurge, a bad, you know, and the good, the father of Jesus Christ. So he has this idea of the Old Testament and the New Testament are at war, like there's the God of the Old Testament versus nice God.
Okay, yeah.
So he's really big on that. Matter of fact, he doesn't accept any of the Old Testament. He only accepts parts of the Gospel of Luke in Paul's letters.
I see.
We have Tatian with encratism, and that was, you know, you just can't do enough to punish your body.
Okay.
Severe mortification as a means of liberation. No meat. You never eat meat. You never drink wine. For a Frenchman, you can imagine how radical that is. No marriage.
Yeah. Okay. So
then we have Montanus, who had these prophecies of the imminent end of the world. He insists on perpetual fasting. We should keep fast our entire life. No marriage, of course. And no attempt to avoid martyrdom. The faster you can get out of the body, the better.
I see. Okay.
And so we have a response to this. So just as we had the response of the pagans, was those apologists, what we have is Irenaeus of Lyon, who in some ways is our first real theologian, he writes a book which we now call Against All Heresies. That's not the real name. The real name, I love this. These kind of ancient titles are hoot. Against what is falsely called knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Gnostic means knowledge. Gnosis is knowledge in Greek.
Right.
So Gnostic means are the ones who know the real truth.
Sure, sure.
And so he's saying against the so-called knowledge.
Okay.
And he really takes them on.
Yeah, yeah. So he's not just, when we talk about Gnosticism, he's not just taking on this one thing, but all of these different ideas that kind of have like a common assumption.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
He goes right to the heart of it. He does a very good job.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he goes a little over in the sense that he loves to make fun of them. And he's saying, where's the basis for all of these supposed beliefs they have, they come up with? Because they don't have a revelation.
Yeah.
So he suggests that, why doesn't it all come, I think he said, like from a big pumpkin? Maybe that's the origin of the universe. And he goes,
the great pumpkin.
Yeah, like a great, it was a gourd, I think, not technically a pumpkin.
Okay.
But you know, that's like saying the whole world actually sort of, you know, comes from a, why couldn't you say that? He said, you have no, you just said you've thought this up.
Yeah.
But you have no basis for these. These are your just imaginations. Mm. So he can really, he has very serious, does a good job presenting the faith, but he sometimes really will just, and he talks about Gnosticism, which one?
Sure, sure. Yeah. Yeah. Which one's the right one?
Yeah. There's so many versions.
So, okay. So he definitely shows their kind of internal inconsistencies, but what's he basing his argument on?
On revelation.
Mm.
So, you know, he's saying, I'm going to show you the real knowledge, and that comes through Christ. Christ just brings us a real knowledge, an authentic one.
Mm-hmm.
It's not our imaginations. We have an authentic access to truth.
I see. I see. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, today, after Christianity has been so, you know, had 2,000 years of entrenchment, it feels like our arguments over what's true and false about the faith come down to essentially just what's Christian and not, or what's orthodox or not based on the tradition. But it's pretty bracing to read a guy who essentially, you know, I mean, he has the tradition of the Old Testament, but he's really just arguing what is reliable and what isn't, you know, well, you know what I mean?
Like he's
not just defending the brand. He's saying, this is what's real. This is what's sure. These other things are not.
This, by the way, is the argument the Apostle John makes at the beginning of his gospel. All these other things are philosophy. We sit down, smart people, and try to think, gee, if I think this out, what could this be? How could I explain this? And John says, it's not like that. How could we actually know? Because the trouble with philosophy is your philosophy is only good as the next philosopher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have a good argument, but somebody else comes with a better. You never know. And John says, like this, the beginning was the Word. The Word is actually with God. The Word was God. And he became flesh. We've seen him.
Yeah.
We have direct eyewitness evidence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We don't have to speculate.
Yeah.
We know.
I see. I see.
And that was what's so radical about that gospel. We don't have to speculate. We know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why he keeps saying witness, you know, yeah, I'm a witness to these things.
Okay. So Irenaeus is picking up on that against the Gnostics and the heretics.
And he said, why does he spend so much time describing their beliefs? He says, it's like this. I love to use the hunting analogy.
Uh-huh.
So you go out hunting like a fox hunt or something. Why do you have the hounds go out ahead? Is when the foxes are hidden, you can't find them.
Mm.
It's by scaring them out so you can see them that you can get them.
Yeah.
And he says, I got to get them out of there. They're hiding in their bushes. We got to get them out of their bushes so you can actually see them. And you say, wow. Oh,
I see. Okay. Okay. Great. Okay. So we've got our, you know, our own internal advances against the Gnostics, but what else is going on inside the church?
A lot. Well, we know early in the second century, the very first years, we had the church is very much in a church planting mode,
mm-hmm.
a lot of wanting. Now the church is really settling down big time because we have with Ignatius of Antioch finding out, because the neat thing about him is he writes letters to seven different churches, including one in Rome and, six that we have in Asia Minor.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them have exactly the same way that they operate. They all have a chief pastor called the bishop, the overseer, who is aided by a council of elders or presbyters or priests.
Yeah.
And they're surrounded by deacons. This is how every church is organized.
Sure, sure.
And so we see the church no longer, the Wild West days, this is like in the West. Now we have a marshal and a schoolhouse and a church in town.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
things
yeah.
Have we and pretty much into that, the threefold order of ministry being, he emphasized that. There's every Christian church has one bishop. you know, a group of elders and a group of deacons.
Okay, so things have organized at this point. And this is widespread, right? Like, he's not just talking about his own.
Well, the very fact that this is not just... The trouble with ancient witnesses could be is we talk about our experience, but how do we know it's true of anybody else?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can make false assumptions. But here he's writing to all these different churches, and it's taken as a given, not like, hey, you guys got to hear what we do.
Yeah.
It's just taken as a given everywhere. Oh, make sure to tell your bishop.
Uh-huh.
You know, and he keeps, you know, and he writes to Rome,
sure,
a place he's never been, and say, I greet the bishop.
I see. Yeah.
So the fact that it's so taken as a given everywhere tells us a lot.
Got it. Okay.
We actually have the Gospels getting out to Germanic areas of the empire. You know, to the far edges, we have reports of people being out there. And we also have Easter. It's settled that we're now going to have Easter is going to be on a Sunday. We're going to have Easter, the Jewish Passover, but we're going to have it on a Sunday.
Okay, I see. So we make sure that's on the right day. Got it.
So at the end of the day, where we really are in the second century, is at the end of the second century, we have Christians everywhere, not just geographically, but at all levels of society,
mm-hmm,
in the elites and the poorest classes. And the church has really made a case of the world.
I see.
An intelligent, profound, a real challenge. It's an intellectual challenge.
Yeah.
It has real credibility now with smart people,
mm-hmm,
saying, wow, this isn't like those cults and things. This is a, you know, this blend of a philosophical approach. There's one God, and his, you know, this is so different from religion as we know it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stories about gods in the past.
Okay. So we're starting to kind of, confidence is starting to pick up that this is more than just kind of, you know, a comfort to, you know, a comfort to small groups of lower class people. This has a real, like, you can really run a world on this stuff.
Yeah, it's getting real, some real credibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Street cred.
Yeah. Great. Well, second century.
Romans, we'll call it via cred.
Second century. The via credibilia. Great. Well,
credibilia in via.
There you go. Well, thanks so much, Father Stephen. Anything else you got for us on the second century?
Wow, have we come a long way.
Yeah.
Again, from 12 apostles locked in a room, we have a movement which has changed the empire intellectually, physically, everywhere. Christians are everywhere. Everyone knows about them. Everyone's thinking about this.
Yeah, you can really see how Thomas Aquinas, you know, all the way down in the, you know, 1100s, can look back on this and say, this is really one of the best proofs for the truth of our religion, is how quickly it spread and how quickly it made it got you know, really articulate defenders, was accepted, you know. So it really is a remarkable story. Well, thanks so much, Father Stephen. That's all the time we have left for this episode, and we will see you guys next week with the third century of the history of the church here on Word and Table. Thanks for listening.